There's a place where dreams are born. It's across the sea and through the storm. Now listen, come with me to this magic hour in ecstasy.
Listening to Other Worlds on Earth, radio show of unapologetic romanticism and utopian yearning for people with unlimited vision. Join us as we make the road by sleepwalking into waking dreams of ecstatic experience. In this episode, I'll be sharing a conversation I had while walking on the mountain with a friend who was visiting from out of town. We revisit and expand on the topic of the last show, the placebo effect. But this time, from a different perspective, we also touch on the magic of radio, summoning spirits, and the temporary autonomous zone of the Tam Tams. So let's get into it. We're both in Montreal, in Canada right now, Quebec, depending on which nation you want to recognize.
None of them.
The correct answer, the third answer. We're at the angel statue. Well, almost. Let's walk up to the angel statue. We're at the angel statue in at the base of Mount Royal in Montreal. The name of the mountain is, so it's told, the origin of the name of the city. Although they're not exactly the same words, and no one's quite sure why. And it's a Sunday, and it's very warm out in the spring. Good Goldilocks temperature, I think. Not too hot, not too cold. Maybe a little too hot. And I wanted to come here because, I mean, any Montrealer who's listening might know this is the time at which Tam Tams would happen. Tam Tams happens very religiously every Sunday, unless it's like pouring rain or something. In all of the warm months. And we are here a little too early, but I'm hoping maybe we could loop back later when it's like a bit more happening. When I first saw it, I was really impressed with the whole event. I mean, it was just way cooler than I ever imagined, way more epic. I imagined like a very small, like, I don't know, circle of people or something, and it's like, at its height, it's not really at its height right now, but maybe in a couple hours it'll be at its height, but there's just a massive drum circle, and just people bring drums, bang on trash cans. It's just like this very improvisational, like celebratory rhythmic drumming that is, and there's multiple large drum circles. Like, it's not even just the one, but I mean, definitely like the main one is like at the base of the angel statue. And strongly associated with the cannabis culture and sort of drug psychedelic culture in general, but definitely not exclusive to that. And yeah, I would say there's kind of like multiple circles of the Tam Tam experience. Like the central beating heart is the drums, like at the center. And then like as you move out further from the angel statue, it's like first you then encounter like, there's like some people that like put out blankets and they're selling kind of like hippie new agey kind of trinkets and stuff. And then a bit further out from that is tons of people. I mean, the range is certainly hundreds minimum at any given week, up to potentially thousands, just depending on its proximity to other major events happening or whatever. Of people just like on blankets, picnicking, hanging out, often smoking weed, or maybe not. And then if you move another circle out from that, there's kind of like a LARPing kind of scene that is around this additional circle around all this happening of people dressing up in like medieval gear and having like play sword fights. And the last time I was here, there was an additional Circolot from that, like someone playing with like a whip. And I only vaguely know about this. I know like there's sort of a revival of interest in like people just like playing with cracking whips and like and there's this like woman just like cracking this whip like wah, wah. Like I wanted to go talk to them, but the person I was with was like a bit leery of like talking to somebody like cracking a whip so wildly. And there's also the I forget what it's called, the thing where people tie the ropes between the trees and like balance on them or whatever.
Slacklining.
Right, slacklining. I say in general there's like a strong circus culture here, so it's like you inevitably have some slacklining. I mean, I there's lots of slacklining just in any given park anywhere you go. But yeah, so it's, let's say like a general like pretty hippie-ish atmosphere, but it's definitely like not only like what you imagine is like, it's definitely not only like what you imagine is like stereotypical like hippie types that like come. They're definitely here in force, but there's also just a quite diverse array of people in every sense of the word that really enjoy and get something out of coming here. And it's like, it's I think a very like anarchistic event, and it's very spontaneous. It is not organized by anyone. It's considered like a Montreal institution. Like everybody knows about it, but it's like there is no plaque talking about like Tam Tams happens here every Sunday. It's like there's nothing like that. There's no person that organizes it. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Facebook group somewhere about Tam Tams, but if there is, whoever's running it definitely has nothing to do with like, I don't know. They wouldn't be critical to it happening. Like it happens because a very large culture of people just want it to continue happening and get so much out of it. And like, I mean, this is purely anecdotal, but I've never seen anybody here fighting or arguing or like screaming or whatever. And it's like, it's just like such a positive, I feel like it's difficult physically to be in the Tam Tam atmosphere and like be upset about something. It kind of just like mellows out all the emotions with or without direct drug intervention. And it is also a, like I said, it's like a Montreal institution, so it's like very accepted kind of cultural phenomenon that is tolerated. It's pretty tolerated by the authorities. Like you'll sometimes see them in the distance, but it's like they pretty much tolerate a lot of like low-level illegal behavior going on. Because I don't know, I would think that like coming down too hard on Tam Tams, it's like so many people care about it. It's like people just don't like, people have kind of positive associations with it and like don't want to hear that like Tam Tams is being repressed or something.
Yeah, the way you're describing it, it's reminding me of the temporary autonomous zone.
Yeah, I would like to think of it as like a kind of temporary autonomous zone. It's weird because it like happens so often, and I think of the TAZ temporary autonomous zone as being this like more rare kind of thing, but certainly I certainly see elements of it.
Another thing that's interesting about how you're describing it and how I have experienced it, which I don't think I've seen the biggest version of it that you're talking about.
Again, I hope that, we could like loop back here and you can see the real full expression.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll see how much it overlapped with the picture I painted.
But, yeah.
But sorry, go on.
Well, I'm thinking about how there's this kind of specialness to the place, both in the sense that there's this mountain. Well, it's called a mountain, although when I first encountered it, I thought it's small for a mountain.
It's definitely small. It's very wide.
It's very wide, and it ends up being dramatic without being large.
Hmm. Like being at the summit, you mean, or in general, or?
Well, it's dramatic partly in the way that the city actually, and the people, it's almost like partly about the land, but partly a social phenomenon in the sense that, like, the way the city has, like, shaped itself around this place, the way that the city is named after it, you know, in sort of, like, typical fashion, the colonizers, like, put this cross on top.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting how the top of the mountain is not actually important in the way that this place is. Like, people don't... Yeah, like, people do go there, but it's, like, mostly this much more, like...
It's more touristy.
Soulless... Yeah, this, like, soulless tourism. And it's not actually the beating heart of the city, which is much more, like, around something like the angel. And so I was thinking about that, that contrast between this, like, very, because even some crosses are even, like, interestingly done, but this one is, like, very, even the design of the cross itself is, like, so soulless, and, like, the architecture up there compared to something like this angelic figure that has this, like, I guess one of the things I think is interesting is that, like, the angel is the dominant figure of this statue, even though the official name refers to this, like, statesman.
The name of the park in front of it?
No, the name of the statue, I think, is after, like,
oh, really?
This statesman who was, like, a big, was, like, influential in, like, the confederation of the different, I don't know, colonial governments of New Brunswick and Ontario and Quebec or something like this. But the angel is, like, so much more powerful than him, and mm-hmm. is, like...
Yeah, I don't think that most people even think about,
yeah.
or maybe know, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
I just see it as, you know, the angel.
Exactly. That's kind of, like, one of the things I think is so interesting, is that even though officially it's, like, about this, like, statesman, like, everyone experiences it as about this angel. And, yeah, I'm just, like, sort of wondering aloud about that dynamic between the official religion and this angelic phenomenon. Like, I've always felt like the angels and the saints and so on were, like, kind of part of this, like, subversive current in Catholicism, where, like, all of the, like, old beliefs have, like, persisted through them, because there's a built-in, like, sense of, like, plurality and difference within sainthood and within, like, I don't know, angelic being. Right, like, the angelic beings have, like, different names and are associated with different things.
Right, and there's, like, saints to pray to for, like, different purposes.
Yeah.
You had, you'd listened to, like, the last episode about
the placebo
effect, yeah. and I don't know, expanding on that, I kind of went into, like, relating that to in at least my intention was not in a invalidating way to kind of religious kind of healing and spiritual type things or whatever, which are usually related to the placebo effect in a rather dismissive way. But I was like, you know, whether you believe there's, like, a concrete scientific healing process going on as a result of these rituals or not, I think either way you could look at it being, like, rather significant that this sometimes rather pronounced, like, effect is happening from what we call, like, the placebo effect of, you know, not just taking sugar pills in a medical context, which is, like, its own kind of like Western medical kind of ritual, but also, you know, whatever this effect is, I feel like probably has overlap with what's happening in more overtly spiritual kind of rituals.
Yeah, I have so many thoughts. I tend to think of the placebo effect as like one of several like secret exits out of like scientific rationalist thinking that has no sort of imagination or nuance around its own like that has no self-reflexive awareness, so to speak, right? Like there's also sort of like these observer effects that happen where like something that happens in a laboratory environment is not the same as something that happens outside of it. And you also see this in like, you know, the field of anthropology, which, you know, these days is not really considered to be scientific anymore, but part of the reason it had this crisis of how rationalistic and how scientific it was because they started to realize how heavy of an observer effect there was, where the people they were quote-unquote studying were in many cases trying to conceal things from them or play tricks on them or like lie to them intentionally because they were outsiders or so on. And I think in the same sense that we've had these crises in fields like psychology and anthropology, there are sort of a lot of lingering crises in fields that still consider themselves to be very rationally based, but haven't sort of managed yet to deal with their own secret exits. My sense is that anthropology has become extremely has been in embroiled in an ever deepening crisis around its own observer effect, and this is like in addition to a crisis around like historical and present day racism and colonialism. Like these are not distinct, right? Because part of the observer effect is the cultural,
like othering.
Yeah. And not only othering, right? But like, you know, hierarchy and so on. But I really think that for me, the best way to understand the crisis that's happening in anthropology, where it's becoming much more about anthropologists studying themselves, that's how I would summarize the reaction to this crisis. It's been that anthropologists have sort of stopped studying the other and have said, well, we can only study the self. And I think for me, the best way to understand this is actually that a kind of strategic victory was won by the people who were resisting the anthropological project, and who, through a wide range of incredibly interesting techniques, like threw the entire field into crisis. Yeah, I see this as like the outcome of the sort of trickery or resistance or, you know, in some cases violence from the people being studied, quote unquote studied. I guess I don't have to put everything in air quotes.
I also liberally use air quotes.
I try not to use them too much.
I forget the comedian, but there's some comedian who like was like a list of 10 type of people I hate or something, and one of them was like people who make quotes in the air. And I just remember hearing that and being like, but that's like a really useful like gesture that like communicates something about what you're saying.
I kind of agree with him because it so easily becomes a
like a sort of cynical, like excessively ironic kind of gesture. Or...
Well, like kind of a substitute for saying something more interesting. Like, you cast doubt on whatever it is, but maybe in this moment before you used their quotes, there was a opportunity to like express it more interestingly, which is true of a lot of gestures and language forms, right? A lot of them are sort of they're too easy, you know? They're
like a lazy way of speaking or analyzing something? Or...
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
That's my... I don't know. It's off topic, but that's kind of my...
So let's then... maybe exit from our anthropology tangent and, at your direction, put a more proper Protestant work ethic into the communication. Lest we be called unproductive.
Well, so the other thing... Another thing that I was thinking about with the placebo effect was how I have tried to use it on myself. But cool. Only with psychedelic effects. So at some point, I'd probably only taken psychedelics once, but maybe two or three times, and I decided it would be an interesting experiment to try to produce the effect without the substance.
Oh, okay.
And I guess, in a way, something about...
Like after you had had a substance...
After I
assisted,
tripped.
Yeah, assisted psychedelic experience, you then tried to produce a similar kind of experience without the substance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that sounds interesting. Do you want to go into any detail for how you tried to do that? Or?
Well, yeah, so I just... Yeah, so I just took water, and what exactly I did with the water, I'll leave out. The sort of ceremonial part. But it wasn't, it was simple. And then drank the water. And, it did have the effect that I was, interested in. It was not, as intense, as like a full dose, which I also was not looking for it to be as intense as a full dose.
My thinking was that this sounds interesting, but it also feels a bit disconcerting, the idea of having a full-blown trip without, like, a substance to ascribe to it.
Yeah.
That's just some of my thinking when you're saying this.
But, yeah, it had the effect I was interested in.
Do you want to expand on it? Was there a visual component, an audio component? You did kind of have visual effects.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
I had visual effects, not very intense, and more or less like when you're starting to trip and
like the come up kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. And then at a certain point it started to sort of fade, and I was just kind of okay with that. And it did occur to me that, like, it was probably the kind of thing that, you know, if I put sort of more practice and more intention and more ceremony and these kinds of things into it, that it might, you know, be possible to go farther. I think in a way that the first time that I, the first or second or whatever time that I used psychedelics, or experienced psychedelics, the experience suggested to me this possibility in some way.
Hmm.
And I think that one of the things that is interesting about it in relation to what we're talking about with the sugar pill is that you still need a substance. Like, you can't just, like, I mean, maybe there's a way to do it without a substance, but, like, you still need a kind of something outside you, right?
Yes.
Right. And I think that aspect is so interesting, because for a number of reasons. But one of the things I think is interesting about it is it for me ends up asking a question about a lot of the things that do exist in the world around us. So for example, like, one of the things you had mentioned in your in the last episode was how researchers into the placebo effect found that the effect was greater if the people presenting it dressed with the right authority.
Mm.
And I thought that word authority was interesting. So what I thought was interesting about this was that it kind of calls into question, like, to what extent certain kinds of authority are sort of part of this. How do you put it? There's this Kafka story called A Country Doctor. Mm. And it's so super interesting. There's a lot going on. Anything I say about it will inevitably leave out a lot of the interesting parts of it. But one of the ideas is that the country doctor sort of travels to the patient. And so there's this, like, kind of summoning that happens, right? And in the story, this summoning already takes on a kind of, like, dreamlike or fantastical character. He's the narrator.
Okay.
So it's you know, at first you might think he's the protagonist. At the end, he's sort of, you know, it's unclear if he's kind of escaped all category of antagonist and protagonist and all of this. Like, he starts off, like, frustrated or sort of, like, flummoxed, because he's been summoned and he's trying to make it there, and he ends up only being able to make it there through a kind of, like
to the patient's house.
Mm-hmm. He only ends up being able to make it there through a kind of, like, magical process. It's like he ends up feeling like he's been kind of, like, whisked there, like without having, like, traveled through his own agency and will and power. And that ends up being part of the story in a way, because he has a kind of like, the patient even ends up saying to him something like, you know, you, like, you can't even stand on your own, you were just sort of blown in here. And he has a kind of crisis around his own station as a doctor, and he says, like, the people treat him more as a kind of, like, doer of miracles, and they kind of, like, summon him to perform this, like, sort of religious function, and where they like might have called the priest, but no one calls the priest anymore, like, in modern times. Like, no one calls the priest anymore. They, like, expect the doctor to, like, be a miracle worker. And he even allows them to do this to him. Like, they sort of like ritually undress him and like sing this song and like it's this sort of like absurd scenario that unfolds, but I think it's also potentially reflective of a interesting outlook on what the doctor is or might be, that they might not be like an agent so much as something that people summon in order to invoke their own healing capacities. And that the authority that they have is this, like, necessary ruse.
Like it's a temporary kind of authority dependent on the ritual?
Well, it's the authority demanded by the patient, right? The patient, like...
It's a reflection of, like, what the patient wants, in a way.
Right.
Is that...
Right, this is, like... This was one
Which
of
is,
the...
Which is different than, like, a... The sense of authority that's, like, kind of imposed without being requested or whatever.
Right. And it even kind of... Yeah, so it raises some interesting questions about authority more broadly, at least in this kind of more healing space that we've been talking about in, you know, the previous episode, that you talked about in the previous episode, and that we've been talking about. There's a way to look at the authority of the healer as something that's like a role that's being played out for the benefit of the built-in healing powers of the patient, which for whatever reason, like desire all this dress up.
Like sort of revealing an inbuilt need for this external stimulus.
Right.
So since we're walking upon it, I think I'll comment. We are walking toward very prominently, we can see near the top of the mountain, the radio antenna, which is used by, as far as I know, pretty much all radio stations in the Montreal area, including of the station which airs this program, CKUT 90.3 FM. And I think it's broadcast with 5,000 watts of FM power, so we are near like the central point of power of the station, of like the origin of where it transmits out these vibrating frequencies, which you can just pick out of the air in an unlimited fashion. Unlike, you know, a live stream on the internet, which is very infrastructure dependent in terms of like scaling the number of people that can listen to it. There's a very big difference between 5 people listening and 5 million people listening. There's no difference between 5 people listening and 5 million people listening as long as they're within the radius of the signal, which I think is like a really interesting reversed aspect of this older technology.
That is really interesting.
I think there's something kind of magical about yeah, like it just being transmitted into space. It's like space is a place that's like occupied and controlled and regulated. It's interesting that like, you know, the state tries to control even this invisible space in the air. And so it's kind of like this interesting struggle happening in the air that's like, on the one hand, invisible in the sense like to the eye, but very much an accessible real thing that is like clearly clearly there. All you have to do is turn on a radio to see there is something there. Do you feel like the way you were describing this in the context of like this story and everything, like that the role of the external stimuli to produce like the placebo-like effect, that is playing a role of like validating, like the role of the authority kind of figure, like are they just primarily validating what's an already like personal ability on behalf of the patient to like heal themselves, and they kind of need the validation? Or do you see it, which like to me, if that's the case, like that sort of like suggests like one could like not have that if
right.
you like worked beyond needing the validation or something and
yeah.
like recognized your own power? Or is it like they're like kind of like a more built-in like important role to that like external stimulus or authority in like how this thing might be working? I mean, you know, you don't have to know the ultimate answer to that, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what I'm suggesting is that at least in a, at least in many kinds of cases that people go to the doctor or summon the doctor to them in the old-fashioned country terms, that in many of these cases, the doctor is unnecessary. Like, you could talk to your friends and they would probably admit this, right? Like, I would admit this about, like, the time I most recently went to the doctor. Like, I was essentially looking for a pep talk on my own healing process,
mm-hmm.
which I was, like, struggling with. And I knew that the doctor would probably also prescribe me some things, and those may or may not have some effect. But those were also things I could get over the counter. And so what I essentially needed was this kind of like pep talk on my own healing process. And I do think that I do think that the fact that like this person is wearing like doctor's clothes and is in a doctor's office makes that more effective for me than if I like went to a friend and asked them for the same pep talk. But I think also that it calls into question to what extent we need those kinds of authorities, at least some of the time. Obviously, doctors do incredibly, like, they do things like surgeries that are incredibly...
beyond maybe your own abilities.
Well, maybe, I'm not even saying that they are necessarily beyond, right? Like, maybe that's just, like... Maybe that's so far that it's inconceivable, right? It's something you would have to sort mm-hmm. of do some leveling up. But those things are also so they're so specialized. They're so different from a pep talk or a prescription of a sugar pill. So it's, I guess, beyond the scope of what I'm trying to say at the moment, at least. Yeah, and I think what I'm particularly interested in here, right, is that there might be ways in which we have actually sort of, where people like, you know, a million years ago, no, less, maybe less than a million, but let's just say a million years ago, like,
a million,
like started,
why not?
Yeah. like started some kind of, process like this, right, of taking a need that they had that they could give themselves but was a lot easier to give themselves by externalizing some kind of authority. I'm thinking partly of like, well, all sorts of roles, like teaching roles, like spiritual teaching roles, like you know, things that I don't even have like a some kind of like extremely developed critique of like, you know, small scale authorities of like, I don't know, teaching a skill to others, or acting in a kind of like spiritual role that, like, I'm not even sure we should call these authorities, because that word is so, has such a different meaning in our world. But I guess what I'm trying to say is just that I wonder whether, like, some seeds were planted a long time ago that for a long time had grown into plants that were, like, perfectly fine, but then have also, like, become a kind of cancer that has, like, grown so far beyond that initial, like, impulse to externalize, that they've actually, like, metastasized into these horrible machines. Like, you hear these stories about these carnivals that people used to do in Europe, where they would still, like mock the king and, like, treat the king's, like, authority as something that could be reversed, at least for, like, a week or two a year. And, like, you could install this new king who was, like, a buffoon and was, like, meant to be...
Yeah, there's this whole great tradition in the past of, like, mock kings.
And it, but what it suggests to me is that people still had a sense that even an authority like that was an expression of their own playful impulses. Or had at least originally been an expression of their own playful impulses.
Like, there was still a sense of connection with that, rather than, like, I don't know, it being totally an origin that's totally invisible or unquestioned.
Right, or completely separated from their power. Right. Their power to manifest, like, a healing figure or a spiritual figure or something like a king.
Well, this sort of reminds me of, and I'm not sure if I'm going to remember, like, the correct tradition that it's part of, but I think in a Tibetan, like, maybe a Tibetan Buddhist monk-type tradition, there's this concept of a tulpa. Have you heard of a tulpa?
No.
It's, like, a spirit that, and this is, like, you know, like, there's a sense in many traditions of, like, spirits that just exist, like, in nature or whatever, like, but a tulpa is a created spirit. Not so much like a spirit that exists all the time that you're summoning, but it is a tulpa that, like, you create through ritual. That, like...
Like an egregore.
I'm not familiar with that term.
Okay. Go ahead.
It's kind of like, yeah, you, like, do this ritual and it, like, produces this tulpa who's then has, like, a kind of power. But it's a power that's very much, like, recognized as something that you, as, like, a group of people, like, praying or chanting or whatever, have, like, created. And I think it might have been in Canada. It might have been potentially at, like, the University of Toronto or something like that. But it's, like, in the 70s or 80s or something like that. They kind of started from this premise of, like, okay, why was there all this more paranormal phenomena during this time period when there are all these seances and everything? And then there just seems to be, in general, like, less of that kind of phenomena. And we're talking about, like, manifestation of spirits that people see, like, table levitation, like, stuff like this. And, of course, like, there was sort of, like, intentional fraud and trickery involved in a lot of these instances, but they sort of started from the premise of, like, we think maybe, like, it's not all fraudulent, all of these, like, tales, because there were, like, thousands of, you know, instances of phenomena like this happening.
And this movement was also very connected to the political subversives at the time.
Yeah, there was overlap. Yeah.
There's significant overlap. Anyway, go on.
Well, do you want to say something about that?
No.
Overlap?
No.
Okay. Well, okay, so we believe that, like, people have the ability to kind of, like, get into, like, a collective mental state where they, like, generate this kind of phenomena. And so they tried, like, replicating seance. They're like, let's just, like, have various like seance-like things and try to do the similar activities with the Ouija board and like candles and like people can like chant and pray and like, you know, want to like summon relatives or whatever. But, it wasn't about summoning relatives or real people. Their idea was, we're going to make up a person named Philip, and I think maybe he had like a full name and like life story. They may have like a little story about a person that definitely did not exist. The idea was like, we want to see if we can summon this person who was absolutely not a real historical person. And we believe that like, it's possible that this person could be kind of, the spirit of this person could be kind of manifested, even though like they're not connected in the sense people usually think of this type of activity of like, you know, resurrecting or being visited by a real person who existed at one point who had died.
Yeah.
And they got real phenomena from doing this. And like, there was apparently some, like the table jumping up and like levitating a bit and, you know, knocking and like things. I mean, that to me is interesting.
No, I think it's all... That's all very much related to what I'm thinking about. Like, yeah, the word I mentioned, so, yeah, so the name I know for that same concept, or it sounds like the same concept, is Egregore, which I might not be pronouncing right. And... It refers specifically to these spirits that are that are brought about by collectivities of people acting together. And there's this new book that just came out, which I believe you picked up yesterday, called Warlike Howling Pure. In that book, the author refers to white supremacy as a egregore. Something created, but something that's not real, but has a spiritual reality, and is the creation of a collectivity of people, essentially magically willing it into existence. And I think by the same token, we can recognize the state and other entities that involve so much collective, like collaborative willing into existence. As at least potentially in the same category. And it doesn't mean that they don't have, you know, material effects in the world. Like you're, like this ghost that knocks things around.
Like, I think what you were saying before about, like, when we were talking about external stimuli and authority, and you were talking about, like, you know, teachers and doctors and, like, you're like, oh, I don't know if I have this, like, very developed critique of, like, these kind of smaller expressions of authority. But it sounded like you were kind of wondering if there was something not necessarily harmful about that at a smaller level that had kind of, like, ballooned over time into, like, people being, like, overly dependent on, like, external authorities. And yeah, I was just thinking about that again because I'm like wondering if it would be like useful as a way of like thinking about these larger expressions of authority like states and et cetera as being kind of this expression on a long timeline of a over-externalization of authority that maybe had at base some kind of more directly useful or healthy kind of application that left unchecked kind of is able to like balloon to infinity. I don't know, does that like resonate at all with what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's exactly along the lines of what I'm saying. Yeah, well, so one of the classic, for me, one of the classic examples of the egregore thing in relation to the state, especially if you live somewhere that used to be part of the British Empire.
Do you remember where the egregore, or however you pronounce it, what culture, tradition, or whatever, this, where this word comes from?
So the word comes from a Hebrew word.
Okay.
Which actually is the name of the watchers. Do you know the do you know the concept of the watchers in the?
This is like a class of is this a class of angel?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I wish I knew, but I don't know how the word evolved from there to the its occult meaning as this manifestation of a collective. Will, especially magical will, but it was the occultist who's like most associated, who like did the most to popularize the term was Eliphas Levy, who was a French, like maybe 18th century, I think 18th century, or maybe 19th. Century occultist had a lot of interesting ideas. For me, the classic example, especially if you live somewhere that used to be part of the British Empire, is that the British Empire itself was the brainchild of a magician named John Dee, who's actually pretty famous as far as magicians go, and I don't know all the details of the story, but essentially, he was a royal magician. He was a court magician, and he proposed to the royalty, which I believe was a queen, but I don't know the queen's name. That this empire would be created. And I think the fact that it was a magician who created such a thing kind of gives you that nice like anecdotal link in this one case, in the case of this one, you know, state entity, but one that has had, you know, such a tremendous and lasting effect.
Mm-hmm.
The settler colonial project in this place and, you know, south of the border was entirely carried out by these imperial projects, which we know at least one was created by a magician.
Does this partially meet my enthusiastic description?
Yes. Yeah, there's a juggler, somebody lifting weights.
Yeah, the weightlifting I don't usually see. That's a more novel thing.
Dancing.
I don't know, I feel like that's like, it's somewhat applicable to look at like the lure of like, particularly like the central feature of the Tam Tams as being like this, you know, rhythmic, unplanned, like improvisational, like drumming together as like building this kind of like exciting, like collective spiritual kind of experience. I mean, I feel like I've felt it at times just watching it without doing any drumming on my own. Yeah, I mean, you referenced earlier that book, maybe you could say the title of. You're not the author of the book, but
no.
It's a book that, you know, you were, a text that you were into and have helped facilitate publishing.
Yeah.
So maybe if anyone's interested in that. And the themes of that are, you said, like anarchist spirituality. There's a bit of Chinese millenarianism in there.
Yep.
Other things to mention about it? Or?
Dionysian history. Mm-hmm. And yeah, overall, I would say it's on the topic of anarchist insurrection or revolution as a miraculous event, and embracing the fact that if it was to happen, would be miraculous.
And if people want to get that book, what's the title and where they could find a way to get it?
Yeah, so if you want to find it, the title is Warlike, Howling, Pure. The best place to get it is Contagion Press, and that is contagionpress.com.